Thanks, Mike. This may not sound super exciting to begin with, but I'd like to start with a bit of a history lesson. Do you need this? Did someone just go away? That's great. Who are the history nerds among us? You will be found out. So we're in Psalm 126, but Psalm 126 has a background. It wasn't created out of nothing. There's a context in which it was written to begin with. And in 538 BC, so quite a long time ago, right? Cyrus, the king of Persia, issued a decree. It was called the Edict of Restoration. It allowed Jewish people to freely travel back to their homeland, back to Israel. So what had happened previously was that Persia and other kind of really powerful outside nations had taken over Israel, taken over the land of Israel, and exported all the people, or imported all the people back to their own country. They came in, they took the land, and took all the people. So now all of Israel are functioning like refugees of war. They're forced to move to places of different languages and different customs, forced to leave their jobs, their daily life. I mean, a few of you, and we've done this too, we've moved to other countries, but willingly, and that's difficult enough. Imagine that happening, you know, without you having any kind of say. But now this edict of restoration that Cyrus issued, and he didn't follow God, so somebody who just kind of some secular king issued, meant these former refugees didn't have to be refugees any longer. They could go back to their own land. They could go back to Israel. They could go back to their homes. And most importantly for the Jewish people, they could go back to the temple. The temple in Jerusalem, the temple was God's meeting place for man. It was the symbol of where God reigns, a symbol of his presence. It was the center of work for the whole nation. It was why Jerusalem was called the holy city or the heavenly city or God's city. So to be restrained from experiencing something good is difficult. To be exiled from God's presence, this created a real longing in God's people, a longing to return. And of course, the same is true for us. The heavenly city is not a particular place on this earth. It's not a particular nation. It's God's presence. It's not confined to a temple, not confined to a place, but it's found in a relationship. To be known and know the maker of heaven and earth, the one who made us and cares for us, is the kind of relationship that can make anything home, anything that we go through, any place that we are. That's how we can be at home. Now, we are not refugees in Persia, and we're not living 600 years before Christ, but we are refugees of another sort, and in a far, far more desperate situation. We are refugees from God himself, which means we're exiled from life itself, from all the goodness that life has to offer. So we don't come into this world as fully fledged citizens of God's kingdom. We come broken, and then also we break stuff. Broken people break things. All the while, in our breaking, we still have this longing. We still have a need for something more. Augustine, who's been a bit of our guide as we've been walking through this psalm, says this about this psalm. He says, "In this life, we are exiles from the heavenly city, and we sigh with longing to return to it." Success in our career, the thing that we worked for, that people told us was the thing. Maybe we get it, maybe we don't. But even if we do get it, what is it? It's just a job. Family life, finding a partner, getting married, having children, being settled, all the things we work for, people told us, no, that's the thing. Will we get it? Does that solve all our problems? No. And those with families, you know, it creates a lot more problems. Building up experiences of life, traveling, holidays, friendships, doing new things, we do them, and they're great when we do them, but really, is it ultimately fulfilling? No, because we have to keep on doing them to keep it up. It's never going to be enough. In this life, we are exiles from the heavenly city, and we sigh with longing to return to it. And there's really, of course, really only one thing that's going to satisfy that longing. One thing that's actually going to come through for us. And actually, it's more than satisfying. The Bible calls it fulfilling. Satisfaction just kind of meets your expectations. A fulfillment is like something overwhelmingly and overflowing. Being all we need all the time is God himself. And all that we search for and all the other wrong paths that we take, whether they're good or bad on the outside, really what we are searching for as human beings made in his image, we are searching for him. It's part of who we are. And then the wonderful and amazing and crazy and actually really insane thing that God did is he made a way for us to come to him. Without Jesus, we are refugees unable to go to our home. With Jesus, now we're always at home. We're never not at home. We always have what we need because we have him. And that's how the first part of the psalm begins, those first three verses here. It looks back to when refugees are refugees no longer, to when exiles are no longer exiles. To be released from an exile is an overwhelming joy to have. So that's what we have in those first three verses. Former exiles looking back at when their freedom was won. That's joy. Remember how God has freed us? That's joy, a kind of joy that other people are going to see as well. This is the joy of freedom. So let's look at what this what the psalm says first here. In verse 1, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion. So the fortunes of Zion, that's the edict of restoration. Cyrus's edict of restoration, that's what it is. When the Lord did that, we were like people who dreamed. When Israel finally had the freedom they're longing for, it was so amazing. It was so great. It was beyond joy in their reality. It's like they had to think of it. It was a dream. This can't even be real. It's like a dream. It seemed too good to be true. Their mouths filled with laughter. Our tongues filled with joy because they were filled with joy, they themselves. And what were they filled with before? They weren't at home. They were filled with this longing for home, a longing to be restored. Having a longing can hurt. It can be really painful to really want something, to really desire something. It can be painful to long for something, to desire something that you don't have and yet something feel like all your cells are just like reaching for it. What was previously longing is now transformed into joy as they look back to this edict, to this restoration. To have mouths and tongues filled with laughter means a joy so incredible it can't be tamped down. The joy has to come out. It has to. Real joy can't be contained. It can't be contained because real joy is so overwhelming. It's so overpowering. We want others to get in on that too. And when we're filled with joy, that joy has to go somewhere because it's too much for it to be in our bodies. It has to go somewhere. It comes out of us. When you come across a great film, like, oh, you got to see this film. I saw this the other day. It was crazy. I got to tell you about it. When you see a really nice sunset, you take a photo, you put it on Instagram so other people can see it. You're like, oh, this thing's wonderful. I want other people to see it. When you hear a good joke, you tell others the same joke, even dry dad puns. And if Paul Birchall was in this room, I'd be looking right at him. Someone who is filled with joy. When you encounter someone like that and you know those kinds of people, you feel joyful. They have a joy that just kind of like comes out. And you're just like, oh, I just love being around that guy. It's really nice. Notice how joy does not come out in self-righteous judgment. And yet, how often can we as a church really be like that? No, joy comes out in the form of laughter, of happy talk. A joyful church is one that really gets what Jesus has done for us. It's not like joy is disconnected from hard work. I mean, think of what they're doing here. They're moving from one country to another. There's loads of difficult things going in there, but there's a joy that carries them as they go. The best way to go through difficult, meaningful things, of course, if you have the option, is with joy. Now, last week, we looked at how the pilgrimage is a dance and how the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit are all dancing around each other and how they bring us into this dance. But this week, what we see is it's not just a dance, full stop. It's a joyful dance. It's a really wonderful thing that we get to experience. And as this joy emanates outward, others who don't have this joy themselves notice it. So look at, if you have, hopefully you do have your Bible in front of you. So assuming you do have your Bible in front of you, look at the second part of verse 2. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The nations is a stand-in for people who don't worship God yet anyway. So then, and when you read that, that's what the nations are. They're looking at the people who do follow God. They're saying, wow, their God has done amazing things for them. That's a pretty incredible thing. They see the good things God's done for them. That means our joy as well as God's work, both of these things, our joy, God's work, become display boards for what God is up to in this world. Display boards for others to see. How are people who don't know Jesus going to hear about him, about what he's done, and what it's like to follow him? How would they get to hear about the joy that we receive? It's no secret. God has told us many times, what he does is he chooses to work through you. He chooses to work through the church, through a joyful family on his mission of joy. So if you don't have this joy, that's not just an issue for you. That's an issue for all the other people that you're connected to in your life. If you don't have this joy on display in some form, not that we need to fake it in like a really kind of lame, hypocritical kind of way, but a real joy that comes from within, if we don't have that on display, that's not just something that we're missing out on, that's something that other people are going to be missing out on. Those nations that want to be saying, wow, God's really done really good things for this person. So how can others know the great things the Lord has done for us? Of course, it's by telling our stories, by telling all of what God has done. We each have different stories, and each of us have many different stories of our own lives, of how God has worked in there. Some of them are really big, some of them are small. All of them are important. But the more a Christian knows about our own exile from God, the more we know the own depths of our sin, how we were really shackled by death, the more joy we're going to have when we realize how much Jesus has freed us from that and how we have been released from that. We were exiled from life, and now Jesus has restored us, and we get all of life. The more that we get that as Christians, the more that will actually be a real authentic joy that comes out and other people will see. I mean, it's so good. It's kind of hard to believe that it's true. But it's the best of both worlds. It's so good and it's true. Now, most of us believe that we're on the path towards something better. That's why we're on the path that we are. Whatever we're doing, we think, oh, well, I'm doing the right thing and should be doing this, right? So the question, though, for all of us is it actually really something better? Are the promises of your way, are they actually really true? Just thinking that they're true, just thinking that they're good, doesn't make them that way. Are they actually objectively, or is it actually really the good thing, the best thing for us? And as a horrible and cringeworthy and lovely example, I came across this last week. Some of you guys already saw some of the slides. In Glasgow, a live Willy Wonka experience, and I love that you're laughing because you already know the story. A live Willy Wonka experience ticket cost £35. And this is what it offered. That looks pretty cool. I don't know if I pay £35, but it still looks pretty cool. Like, if you have little kids, oh man, this is great. It'd be day out. You'd get the kids out and do something. Well, I bet you can imagine what happened next. Here's reality. Slightly different. Just slightly different. According to people who went, and I read many news stories about this. I had a friend in America that told me, have you heard about this? And I was like, no, send me more. And he sent me like 5 or 6 different news stories. There was a script that actors had that they were going throughout. Apparently, it was like 15 pages of AI-generated rubbish. There was a made-up villain called The Unknown, as if you need to make up more villains than Willy Wonka. Then this made-up villain called The Unknown hid in walls, and it was some kind of like secret chocolate creator. I don't understand. I don't really understand at all. By the way, oh, here's another good one. That looks cheery, doesn't it? The event had no chocolate. Willy Wonka's chocolate experience, no chocolate. Kids got 1 or 2 jelly beans and a couple of lemonade. £35. So these tickets were sold using AI images, not real life images. So that is not a real image. It was just made, computer generated. This is what it's going to look like. This is what it was like in reality. And surely the best photo of all time. This is what they paid to get. Imagine trying to sell a ticket with that. Hey, come along, £35. Come on, Glasgow, let's do this. Well, kids were upset, parents were upset, and in the end, even the police were called, which is fantastic. And I think actually all the tickets were refunded in the end. But as hilarious as that is, this can be a lot like the pursuits in our own life, this right here. We chase after something only to find out it actually wasn't real at all by the time we got there. It's not AI generated, but it's generated through the media we consume. It's generated by the books and podcasts that we read. It's generated by the people that we talk to and whose advice we receive. And finally, when we do get there, it's never as good as what we first envisioned. But there's one exception. There's one exception to that. Actually, this is true of probably every other pathway of life, every other thing in life, whether it's a job or family or people, whatever. And those things can be really great. But there's one exception to that, is life with Jesus is always actually better than what's described. No one has ever done an adequate job comprehensively describing the love of God in a book, in a song, in an emotion. You can't scrape the bottom of it. There are no words or emotions or songs or books that will ever overstate God's love for you. You can't make too much out of being freed from death to life. Life with God doesn't need an AI-generated fake image to fake us into following him, because the real thing is better than anything we or any kind of computer could ever imagine or come up with ourselves. So when you're buying the tickets in life, and we buy tickets all the time, the time that we spend, those are tickets that we buy. Where we spend our money, those are tickets that we buy. The people that we hang out with, those are tickets that we buy. What we do with our free time, these are all tickets, and we are all spending money in all kinds of different ways. But wherever we buy our tickets, make sure the thing that you bought is good enough to come through for you. Make sure it's actually what it says it is. Something that won't let you down, that won't be overhyped, but in real life isn't some kind of lame substitute, but is the thing that you actually long for. If you're going to spend your time, spend your money, spend your relationship, spend your emotional energy or whatever it is, it's worth it being worth it. You're worth too much to waste it. Those who have been unshackled from death by Jesus, brought into life by him, we have experienced this restoration. We already have it, and nothing you can do can ever change that. You already have it. Another word for restoration is renewal or revival. Jesus has revived us, brought us new life. He's renewed us. He's made us a new creation. This has already been done by his life, his death, and his resurrection. So let's not forget that. The basics of the Christian life are always going to be the most primary, important things in the Christian life. We will never get beyond that, even as we learn more about it. And the more we learn about his restoration in our lives, the more we're going to have joy, and the more that will, like, in an authentic way, actually overflow to other people. You know, that's verses 1 through 3. That's all like great news. It's amazing things. It's like it's beyond what they can actually think of reality. But in verses 4 through 6, there's a change now. Where 1 through 3 was like the past about this wonderful thing that we found and now we get to have it. And isn't this amazing? 4 through 6 is looking to the future, looking for something that we actually don't have yet. And what it is doing is looking for joy while in sorrow. Looking for joy while in sorrow. So let's go back to our history lesson. So the Jewish people, they were now, they're out of Persia, on their way back to Israel, and they're now there in Israel, now free to live where they wanted. They go back home, but it's different. If any of you have left home and gone back to it, you know that's the same. Home is never the same if you go back to it. Israel was destroyed. The temple, that's no longer there. That has to be rebuilt. Their homes, they aren't there anymore. The walls are crumbling. There's all sorts of stuff. Their whole city, their whole place needs a restart. Everything in ruins. It's a wasteland. And that was tearful because they built this thing up in their heads. This is going to be like, you know, this amazing thing we're coming back to. Oh, actually, it's loads of work and it looks like a wasteland. This is cause for weeping, for sorrow. So now coming after that kind of exuberance of joy, of being able to return. Now there's this new challenge ahead, one where pain and suffering is included. And it's not just pure joy. It's other things as well. Return from the exile was not all as it envisioned to be. So they were released from the exile, but released into what? They're released into a wasteland. But what's happening here in all this being encapsulated in one psalm is the joy of the past becomes hope for the future. The joy of that past that they have, they're able to take with them, becomes a hope of them being able to envision what the future can look like. It shapes their spiritual imagination. And this is what our pilgrimage looks like. Between the past and the future, what Jesus has already done and what he's not yet done, this is where we are. This is our present. So even as we experience the joy of restoration, there's a request for more. If you notice that, it says, when the Lord restored our fortunes, in verse 1, he's already done it. Isn't that amazing? But verse 4, they're asking the Lord to restore our fortunes. They experience that restoration, but not yet completely. They're asking for more. Restore our fortunes, Lord. And the metaphor that's used here is like streams in the Negev. So the Negev region was like in the southern part of Israel. It's a really dry, arid kind of place. In the summer, basically, because there was no rains or anything like that, no life was really there. It was kind of really dead in the summer. But when winter would come, winter rains would come. And all those formerly dry stream beds are now filled with water, flowing with water, and then life actually comes back to that area. It's very kind of, in the winter, it's different. So that is how the psalmist is asking the Lord to restore their fortunes, bringing the idea of a dry, parched land becoming a place teeming with life. That's what we do with our own lives, our dry, parched lives, our dry, parched souls, that it might teem with life again. We're planting something, and as we sow, verse 5 says, we sow with our tears. What are the seeds? The seeds are our tears. The water needed for this crop comes from our suffering, our longings that are not yet completely fulfilled. So this isn't just like generic suffering or sadness in general. It's a very specific kind of suffering, a specific kind of longing that's not yet fulfilled, of wanting something to be restored by God, but not restored yet. And that in us produces a suffering. And out of those tears, that's where life comes. To sow in tears is to see places where God wants to work, where we want God to bring healing, where we want God to bring new life, where we want God to bring his justice, not some kind of lame version of it, his comfort, not just some kind of lame version of it. If we're in tears, it's the things that are closest to our hearts. We don't cry about things that are far away from us. We don't cry about things that are abstract. We cry about things that are really close. In those places that are close to us that cause us to weep, we hope for things that are close enough to us for us to weep. And since we're living in his restoration, we know at some point, we don't know when, but we do know at some point, we will gather up this harvest with, as it says, right after sowing with tears, we will reap with what? With songs of joy. We sow with tears, but we reap with songs of joy. So we're confident. We're confident that the restoration that God started and that we experience now will be completed. And notice that's repeated, songs of joy. This comes up in the first part. Our tongues were filled with songs of joy. And what are we looking forward to? We're looking to songs of joy. But right now we're sowing in tears. We anticipate singing with joy in the future, even as we look back on the songs of joy that we already have. And this is what being a Christian looks like right now, in the moment, between what Jesus has already done and what he's yet to do completely. And our tears are now part of our spiritual migration as we go. Sowing in tears is not only the only part of the Christian life, but it's an important part. It tells us our sorrow and our suffering is actually for something. Now, maybe you're confronting something now and you don't know really even what you can do about it. Like, I don't even know how to even deal with this thing. The darkness of this world maybe has its hold on something, on someone, and you're powerless before it. What can you do? What can you give? You can give your tears. It's one thing you can always give. Do not overlook bringing your pain and suffering before God. Give your tears. Give them in anticipation of God transforming them into joy. Just like planting in a dry and parched land, the only way that life is going to come is if the God who brings rain brings his rain to come, to completely dependent on God. This is how we work. Like without our tears, with our tears, we're completely dependent on him to transform them into joy. Jesus himself told us, blessed are those who mourn, for they're going to be comforted by his comfort. So give what you got. And sometimes all you got is tears. These two are useful in God's kingdom. And verse 6, as it's written, is written as a certainty. Those who go out to weeping, carrying seeds to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them, will return with songs of joy. This is what's going to happen. This guy who's written this has not experienced this yet, but he knows it's going to happen. Not just carrying a little bit of joy with them, not just a tiny bit of joy, sheaves, bundles, heaps of joy. Heaps of joy are in store for those who go out weeping and irrigating the ground with their tears. And as certain as our past restoration, and if you're a Christian, that's what you base all your confidence on, what Jesus has already done in the past. As certain as we are there, and we ought to be as certain in the restoration of the future. Looking back at our restoration, we look forward to more of it. And the ultimate revival, the ultimate restoration, the ultimate renewal is in the new heavens and earth, where all this will be completely made true. This is the place all who follow Jesus are going to. Anyone can get in on that, by the way. The path before us might be tear-stained, but the path in front of that is a big heap of joy. The new heavens and earth is when God finally restores all, a renewal that, when it does finally come, doesn't want another one, and doesn't even need another one, because it's done. It's when all of our tears will not only be wiped from our faces, but those tears will be transformed into songs of joy. Joy that we're there. Joy that others are there, most importantly, joy that God is there. And that's better than any kind of retirement or pension plan can offer. Now, here's the thing with tears and sorrow and suffering. All of us are going to have them. All of us will. All of us will sow the ground that we walk on with our own tears in this world. This world is full of wonder, but it is full of decay as well. It's a wasteland. This world is full of promises, but not in a way that we can reach them on our own. Ecclesiastes, that the Savior Conference is going to talk about, one of the big themes is that God has put this sense of eternity in our hearts in a way that we can't actually figure it out by ourselves. So with this image of a beautiful city of light and life out there in the distance, we walk. And no matter how long we walk by ourselves, we can't seem to gain any ground. It's still out there, never any closer. And still we're walking. And still we have these tears. What are we going to do with them? And this thing never seems to get any closer. We're exiled from that place. That place has all the light. That place has all the life. And we can't seem to get there. We're exiled from where we were meant to be because we're captives of death in this spiritual wasteland here. And we came into the world this way. And we also did this to ourselves. As Augustine comments on this psalm, we had the power to sell ourselves, but we don't have the power to buy ourselves back. We could easily sell ourselves wherever we want to be, but never actually where we were meant to be. And Jesus saw us while we were a long way off, trying to make our own way to that city. And what he does is he came to us. The way that God made to come from him, the way God made for us to come to him was for him to come to us. He came to us. He saw our chains. He saw our longings for home. And he knew that we couldn't get there. No matter how long we walked, we would never reach it. We were exiled from him, and what Jesus created was a new edict of restoration, something even better than Cyrus's edict. Well, if the one that Cyrus issued in 538 was so amazing for an Israelite to say, like, we couldn't even fathom it was like people who dreamed, what about Jesus's restoration? This should completely blow our minds. And Jesus' edict of restoration, he releases us, he redeems us. He's the redeemer. Our church is called Redeemer. That's assuming that there are people who need to be redeemed, people who are in need of redemption. And to redeem anything requires a cost. Something must be bought in order to be redeemed. And what he does is he buys us for himself and he pays the ransom. The way he did this was for him to be exiled himself. The creator of all the good things took on all the bad things that exiled us from God. All our sin, all our brokenness, all our guilt and shame, the thing we're going to confess later on, Jesus took it from us. He placed it upon himself and paid the ransom with his own blood. The cross was such a dishonorable thing, such a shameful thing. It was actually so kind of horrible that no crucifixions would take place in the city. Because even though it was wildly popular and everyone wanted to see it, just the idea of a crucifixion happening in the city walls, it's like, oh, it's just too horrible. In fact, only certain classes of people could be crucified because it's just a horrible, dishonorable, like shameful, disgusting thing. It was so horrendous. And so Jesus takes a cross on his back, starts in the city, takes a cross on his back, walks out of the city, walking the path of an exile, in sorrow, tear-stained, his death all the while looming in front of him, forever leaving that city never to return in the same way. Then on the cross, Jesus dies. And with that death, all of our deaths. With his exile, our exile. Romans 6:5 says, for if we've been united with him in a death like this, and for Christians we've been united to Jesus, therefore in a death like that on the cross, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like this. So this is the joy Christ found in his sorrow, that we will be filled with his joy. That was Jesus's joy. And through his work, we're now released from our exile. And even as these songs and joy flow up out of us, we see, yes, no more exile, but this is not yet home. We're in a wasteland. We aren't home yet. We're now making our migration towards this beautiful city of light and life that we could not reach before, but now we're on our way. And the way there, though, isn't always great. It's difficult. It's a difficult road. And so there we are, God's pilgrim people on his way. He has turned us around. Now we face him. The world is at our backs. And though we are still spiritual refugees, we are actually going somewhere now. We're making ground now. We might have tears. Everyone will have tears. But only those of Jesus will know with certainty that one day those tears will be transformed into songs of joy. They will. Even as difficult as it might be to understand it, they will. Only Jesus, only those who have Jesus can have that certainty. Can have that certainty of where our sorrow will eventually lead us. The journey of pilgrim hearts is one of joy and sorrow. But even our sorrow will be transformed into songs of joy. Heaps of joy. And so as we come up here to the table, picture that same walk that Jesus walked. We're connected.